So much of the way we approach the Book of Malachi looks like gold mining. When I was a child, I used to spend time on a beach, and one of the ways we whiled away the day was to go looking at pebbles. And sometimes we'd be thrilled because we'd find a pebble with a shiny vein of mineral in it that was vaguely golden in colour, and we'd run off to distract a determinedly resting parent with the excited proclamation that we'd found some gold. You'd pick your pebbles by colour, reflectivity, you'd put them in a little plastic bucket like treasure, and you'd take them back to wherever you were staying and you want to keep them. But pebbles belong on the beach and they're actually no use away from there. There's no value to them, and your parents would give it a day or two, see if you realised the truth about them. And if that didn't work, they'd set about the task of trying to persuade you they were not going into the car boot to be taken home. No point, no value, out of their context, put them back. Now, there's nothing wrong with collecting pebbles, and there's nothing wrong with gold in itself, but if we're going to be able to identify it as gold rather than fool's gold, we need to look into it just where it's turned up, to examine the context in which we found it. And where the Book of Malachi is concerned, so many evangelical Christians seem to treat it like a big old beach with pebble on it from which they extract shiny-looking ones from their broader situation and context, stick it in their bucket and carry it off, presuming they've found gold. But all the while, the context doesn't support that assumption. Several elements in this book of Malachi suffer in this way. So, for example, people come along and grasp Malachi 2:16, the first part of that verse, I hate divorce, and they take this as an absolute prohibition against divorce holding for all time and in every situation. And you know, that can be harmful. That approach has led to women and children being sent back into abusive relationships that have proved not only discomforting, but lethal. Malachi 3, 10-12 often gets quoted in the course of teaching about tithing, giving to the Lord's work, but not in a way that reflects the meaning of those verses in this book. And then, of course, the last two verses of chapter 4 refer to the return of Elijah, ushering in the day of the Lord. But that has to be seen in the context of what the Lord says about this referring to the ministry of John the Baptist, operating in the spirit of Elijah, calling the people back to God as his forerunner, the forerunner of the Messiah. So please understand that what we're going to do with this book of Malachi, in the run-up to the celebration of the Nativity, is to see it in its original context and draw lessons to be learned from the author's intended meaning, before bringing that message then forward into the setting of the church and of ourselves in our time. And boy, there's some powerful stuff here in this book that the plucking shiny pebbles from the beach approach to biblical interpretation simply hides, obstructs, and covers up. Let's ask the fundamental questions then, as we're looking at chapter 1, verse 1 of Malachi today. Firstly, who? First of all, who is this guy Malachi? Who is he addressing? Malachi is not a name from anywhere we know about elsewhere in the Old Testament. It's a Hebrew word. It means my messenger. My messenger. So this appears nowhere else in the Old Testament as a name, and certainly the Greek translation of the Old Testament doesn't translate it as a name, but it quite plausibly could have been his name. You know how we give names in Wales to people according to the work that they're doing. Well, that's the sort of idea, perhaps. We just don't know. We don't need to. He really is only the messenger. Of Malachi, then, we know at most no more than his name. Possibly not even that. But we do know when he came and what we have got here in this book. So first, what is this book? What? What's the next question? Who? What? One important aspect of the ancient order of the Hebrew Bible, it's referred to as Tanakh, the Torah, the law, Navim, the prophets, Ketuvim, the writings. One of the most important aspects of that is that the 12 prophetic works of Hosea through Malachi, sometimes referred to as the minor prophets, were designed as a single book called the 12. And Malachi is the final book of the 12. That's not an indication of when the events of the book took place. We'll come to that later. At this point, we need to ask what this book actually is, because the author makes a lot of that in Malachi 1:1. Firstly, it's an oracle, we're told. An oracle. This word here, oracle, gets discussed a fair bit. The Hebrew word masah means an utterance, an oracle. It's developed from the word meaning a burden. A burden. Some translate it a pronouncement. It arises from that slightly different word meaning to lift up. And for that reason, there are those who suggest the idea is to lift up the voice and speak out, often used in the Old Testament for delivering an unwelcome message to the people. I guess that's where the burdensome bit comes in. And it's a burdensome responsibility to do this. And it involves conveying a message that comes sometimes as a burden to the people it addresses. This oracle, then, it's described for us further here as word of the Lord. This book of Malachi is not a matter of Malachi lifting up, carrying the burden of his own voice, shouting his own stuff. Because of this further description, the oracle is actually the word of the Lord. What it amounts to, not the word of the prophet, but the Devar Yahweh, this word of the Lord. And the expression throughout the Old Testament always denotes divine revelation. This is coming straight from on high. Notice it isn't the word of God, perhaps the expression we'd use more readily in our time and culture, in our language. It's the word of the Lord, the covenant name for God. It is the pronouncement of the God of the covenant, who's got history with them and relationship with them of old. So this book is absolutely being presented to us as sit up and listen material. Sit up and pay attention. Because of the authority with which it comes, because of the authority of the one from whom it comes. This divine revelation is what we've got. It's the authoritative word of their covenant God and King. And furthermore, that word is addressed, directed in a focused manner at a specific named group of people. What is it? It's an oracle. It's the word of the covenant-keeping God to Israel. Malachi is presented to us then, this book, as the covenant God speaking directly to his covenant people. It's the Lord's word to Israel. Now, without getting too bound up in this, by the time Malachi was written, the distinction between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah has been consigned to history. And this name, Israel, had reverted to describing all the descendants of Jacob drawn from all 12 tribes of the Old Testament people of God, or at least those who had returned to the land of Palestine. And the language and the people engaged in the interactions in this book are clear, directly spelled out. The person running between them with the message is Malachi. It's an oracle. It's the word of their covenant-keeping God to Israel, the covenant people, through Malachi. It's saying here, it's all those things we've just heard, by the hand of Malachi. Almost as if he's been given an envelope to come with, and it's so directly from God that he's just bringing the envelope. You get the same expression in, for example, Haggai chapter 1, verse 1, and also in Haggai chapter 2, verse 1. It emphasizes the prophet is just a human instrument, a go-between figure carrying a communique that he just passes on. And that fits in well with the way this book works out, so much of it consisting of God addressing direct speech to the people through Malachi. So there's the who and the what. Now here's the when, and this is very important if we're going to understand the message of this book and its relevance to us. Here's the background against which this message is being delivered. When. Okay, so Malachi clearly lived in Judah after the return from the exile in Babylon, which then became run by Persia. And we know that because of the reference in chapter 1, verse 8, to the governor as the person who in those days was there in that geographical location as the representative of the Persian Empire. You see, the temple had been rebuilt by the time Malachi was ministering, and that temple was completed in 515 BC. You've then got to allow some time for the things described in this book in the people's behaviour to have developed after the rebuilding finished. And that takes us to the general reckoning that Malachi lived about 60 or 70 years after the Israelites had returned from Babylonian exile. So he's roughly about the same time as Ezra and Nehemiah. And his message was directed to the people who'd been living in Jerusalem for some time now. The book reckons the temple had been rebuilt a while ago. But if you recall the stories in Ezra and Nehemiah, things were not going so well at this time. When the first Israelites had returned from the exile, hopes were high. They anticipated they would rebuild their lives and the temple, and all the great promises of the prophets would come true pretty much straight away. The Messiah, they reckoned, would come fairly promptly and set up God's kingdom over a unified Israel and over the other nations, bringing peace and justice and the good life. But he hadn't. It hasn't worked out like that, and this had produced a very regrettable effect on the people. And that makes pretty clear the why of the book, the reason it was written. Who, what, when, now why? Frustrated by the wait for what they'd expected to see promptly from God, the Israelites, who repopulated the city of Jerusalem and the surrounding territory after the exile, those Israelites proved to be just as unfaithful to God as their ancestors had been before the exile to Babylon. They lost the enthusiasm of the people who'd initially returned to the land to rebuild that temple. Worse than that, you see, this became an age of religious disillusionment and discontent. Disillusionment and discontent. The people were drifting away. Now, does that ring any bells for you? Are we living in such a time as that now, do you think? An age of religious disillusionment and discontent? Well, I could take you to the newspapers, I think, and illustrate the fact that that is our time. Now, obviously, confronted earlier by the prophet Haggai, the people of Israel had seen the point, admitted the temple ought to be rebuilt, accepted they ought to start immediately. But by the time of Malachi, things had deteriorated. So now when they were challenged about how they were relating to the God of the Covenant, they could see nothing wrong with their behaviour or with the way they approached God in worship. In fact, they defended their poor behaviour and more than hinted that what had gone wrong was that the Lord had not delivered on his side of the covenant. Here's the thing. This had become a time of advanced religious cynicism. The temple had been built, but where were the crowds that were supposed to come flocking to it from all the nations as they felt they'd been promised? See Zechariah 8, 20-23. There were some pretty good promises made to Zerubbabel about the shaking of the nations in Haggai chapter 2. But in apparent defiance of those, their land was still economically and politically on the back foot. What about the great return of lots of Jews coming back from the dispersion to repopulate and build the place, as in Zechariah 8, 7-8? As Nehemiah 7, 4 shows, it really hadn't worked out like that yet. And perhaps worst of all, the way they saw things, they were still, in effect, living under Persian overlords and not technically all that free. So, considering all those things, it's John L. Mackay who suggests in his commentary that to these Israelites, things looked pretty discouraging. They had expectations, you see, and they weren't met. Mackay says, they felt they'd done their part for God, but he had not responded as he had promised. And as a result, they thought the way to get on was to ignore God and get what they could for themselves. We read about that in Malachi 3, which we'll come to in due course. Now, as a result of all of that, as a direct consequence of their falling into religious cynicism, their conduct deteriorated. And Jerusalem became a place of poverty and injustice once again, as it had been before all the learning that had had to take place during the exile. In the book of Malachi, we find out just how corrupt this new generation had become because of their growing spiritual cynicism. So Malachi is sent, firstly, to expose and then to counter the scepticism and the behaviour, the disobedience to God, that was on show in Jerusalem. See, it's not just about those little golden nuggets, fool's gold perhaps, that we pull out of their context and try and take home in our bucket. There's a lot going on here we need to understand to see the relevance of all of that to the times in which, arguably, we are living now. Well, how does all this happen? Who, what, when, why? how. We're looking here at the structure of the book because structure, big structure, large structure, gives you a clue to meaning in this sort of literature. The book's designed then as a series of disputes or arguments. The people are arguing back with God, and well, that it's typical of the situation that the book then should be organised, arranged as a set of disputes or arguments between the people and God. Most sections begin with God saying something or making a claim or an accusation. And that's then followed by Israel disagreeing or questioning God's statement. And then finally, God responds and offers the last word on the matter. And that pattern repeats itself six times. Two groups, three disputes each, six disputes altogether. In the first three disputes, chapters 1 and 2, God exposes Israel's rebellious and poor choices. The first three expose, and the final three confront the people. So in that first group of exposure, then, the first dispute starts, as God says, he still loves his covenant people Israel, despite their failures. And Israel rudely says, how have you shown us love? Well, we'll see how that goes next time. And the second dispute then exposes a problem with Israel's second temple. God accuses the people of despising him and defiling that temple, while the people fire back, how have we despised you? And God responds by focusing on how the people are bringing shameful offerings of sick and blemished animals. It shows they don't value or honour their God in their hearts. And in the third dispute, final one in the first group, exposing things, God accuses the Israelite men of treachery against him and their own wives. And of course they deny that, so God exposes that toxic combination of idolatry and divorce that was taking place. That's the first group of three. And then it brings us to the second group of disputes. And that begins with the fourth dispute in the list, Malachi 2:17. And that begins with the Israelites accusing God of neglect, saying, where is the God of justice? Do you know, this, all of this rings so true with stuff we're hearing and seeing in our world, in our contemporary society. See, those people reckon they're seeing injustice and corruption abound, while God, they think, seems to do nothing. God responds by saying he will send a messenger who will prepare the people for his personal return on the day of the Lord. And that day of the Lord is going to come like a fire to purify his people and to remove idolatry, sexual immorality and social injustice, so only the faithful remnant is left to become his people. It's not that God's doing nothing, you see. This is what's coming, boys. It's coming down the pipe. It's on the way. You won't like it necessarily, unless you're part of God's faithful remnant of people. That's the fourth one. In the fifth dispute, God calls the people to turn back to him, to which the people say, how? How can we do that? And God confronts their selfishness, and he reminds them they stopped offering a tithe from their income to the temple. Now, the Old Testament law taught that when God blessed the people with good things, they should share a portion of that back, that benefit back to him. But Malachi highlights that the people had neglected that responsibility, so the temple fell into disrepair and so on. And God confronts them, saying that while he wants to bless them with abundance, he will only do so if they're faithful, because it's a covenant. And then comes the final sixth dispute. The people accuse God, saying it's pointless to serve him. Oh, that sounds relevant, doesn't it? They observe wicked, prideful people succeeding in life all the time, but God seems to do nothing about that. And the response to all that, for the first time in the book, is not a speech from God, but a short story. And it's a short story about the faithful remnant in Israel who still fear the Lord and love to talk together about how to honour and serve him. Now there's the broad overview of the disputes, and I plan to be unfolding those disputes over the coming weeks, show what they've got to teach us in our era of religious scepticism and disillusionment. But for now, let's just say the overall impression you get from reading these disputes is that the exile had fundamentally not changed anything in the people at all. Their hearts are as hard as ever. Their hearts are not changed. But in chapter 4, verses 1 to 3, the conclusion of all this develops coming of the day of the Lord themes of the coming of the day of the Lord, to highlight the fact that God has appointed a day of purifying judgment to eradicate the wicked and the wickedness from amongst his people, with this proviso. There is still a future for the faithful remnant of his people who are in the land, living through these times, but doing so faithfully. That faithful remnant for whom that coming day of the Lord will be a source of joy and not dread. A day when, chapter 4, verse 2, "For you who revere my name, the Sun of Righteousness will rise with healing in its rays, and you will go out and frolic like well-fed calves." It's a glorious picture of this bunch of calves full of life and energy, enthusiasm and joy, because they have what they need on that day when the Sun of Righteousness will rise with healing in its rays. So now the disputations have ended with the warning of judgment against the impatient and disillusioned, whose impatience and disillusionment and cynicism amount to basic faithlessness and lead to disobedience and idolatry. We see that progress, procession, in our own day and times, I would think. But it comes with a warning to the wanderers, this promise, a promise to the faithful remnant, that in that same day of the Lord, those who revere the Lord's name in the faith-testing crucible of their present times will then find that the Sun of Righteousness rises for them, bringing healing for them in his wings. You see, the fact that the cynics feel sorry for their lot is no guarantee the Lord will sympathise with their view of things, certainly not if that feeling sorry for themselves leads to rebellion against him. How's that? Well, it's in this sort of context the Lord's conclusion of his parable of the persistent widow in Luke 18 begins to make more sense to us. The woman has persisted with this unjust judge and it's gone her way, kind of thing. And then verse 6, "And the Lord said," and this is his interpretation of that parable, "Listen to what the unjust judge says. And will not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry out to him day and night?" You see, they're sticking with him. They're being faithful and sticking with him, not going off in religious cynicism. "Will not God bring about justice for his chosen ones who cry out to him day and night? Will he keep putting them off? I tell you, he will see that they get justice and quickly. However," and this is the kicker, this is the big deal, "he will see to it. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?" Humanity cries out. The people in Malachi were crying out. And the Lord is addressing his own days when things were not going great for the people of God, let's face it. In all those times, humanity cries out for justice, as if, after all its own injustices, humanity's own injustices, it is owed, receiving its own view of what constitutes justice, and is owed it by God. Don't we see that? People demanding justice from God after all the injustices of humanity. How familiar does that sound in our times? Now, in this parable of the unjust judge, the Lord's clear that even those human beings set up in society to give us justice, the judges, are inherently unjust. We all have the taproot of injustice and much more running deep within us, which is why Christ's death on the cross to pay the price of sin and justification by grace through faith alone is absolutely vital for us all. And that's why the big issue is not that we don't feel we're getting a good crack of the whip from God, but whether the Son of Man will find faith on the earth when he comes, putting things right, so that our wrong doesn't drag us under his fierce judgment. Now, if we can grasp that message, it holds potential to be life-changing for us, and it will hold us in that faithful remnant for whom the day of the Lord is like the Sun of Righteousness arising with healing in his wings. But this religious cynicism, nurturing disillusionment, is death to that hope. Conclusion. Malachi's conclusion comes in what some have described as an appendix. It's not. it's very much to the point. Chapter 4, verses 4 to 6 says this: "Remember the law of my servant Moses, the decrees and laws I gave him at Horeb for all Israel. See, I'll send the prophet Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the hearts of the children to their parents. Or else I will come and strike the land with total destruction." Well, there's the thing, you see. There's what's coming. And there's the statement, if you like, of what we've been working towards and what's been going on across the face of the book. This passage at the end there of Malachi 4:4-6, it comes as a piece of unequivocal, direct speech from God. And its message is for God's people whose faith has been poisoned by jealousy and disillusion and who have given way to cynicism, scepticism and rebellion. And the direct speech delivers God's counsel in days also just as these. God says, take your imaginings and your spiritual depression in hand and get back to the law, Moses, and the prophets, like Elijah. And God then promises not that the great and dreadful day of the Lord will not come, because it must, but that before it comes, he will send one in the power and in the spirit of Elijah, the great prototypical prophet, who called the people back to the law and the covenant that regulated their relationship with God. That which they and Malachi's hearers had violated, and which their disillusioning experience was the fruit of. They'd got away from the book. But then Elijah will come for a very explicit reason. The purpose he's sent for is intent on being thoroughly restorative of the damage cherished disillusionment has done to these people. He will turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the hearts of the children to their parents, or else I'll come and strike the land with total destruction. Again, going to Luke's Gospel, and there you'll find the words of the angel of the Lord, John's father Zechariah, way back in Luke 1:13 following. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth, for he'll be great in the sight of the Lord. He's never to take wine or other fermented drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before he is born. He will bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God. And he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts, get this, reflecting Malachi 4, to turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Well, well. The lesson of Malachi then is this. In days of spiritual depression, giving rise to disillusionment, religious cynicism, and charging God with unfaithfulness and injustice, days then like ours, firstly, says Malachi, get back to the book. Heed the law, Moses, which should regulate your relationship to God. Secondly, heed the prophets, the people sent by God's grace, who call you back to living faithfully again in the light of the book, in that relationship with God that you were made for. And then thirdly, watch prayerfully for his sending of powerful days of spiritual renewal for the faithful remnant that he will call out from the theoretical body of his people. And that's the point, and that's the purpose of the book of Malachi. And that's the brief summary of what it says. To days like the days of its readers, and to days of spiritual depression and declension, days of disillusionment and turning from God, just like our own. God bless you. Let's think about these things as we dig into this book of Malachi and run up to the Christmas season. The appearance of John, who came in the power and the spirit of Elijah, and the coming of the Son of Righteousness, who comes with healing in his wings.